When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. What I like to do from time to time on this podcast is look at these conventional narratives that we tell ourselves, that we've been kind of, that have been popularly disseminated, and to really examine sort of revisionist accounts. And there's a kind of a really good example of this that comes from the military historian Max Hastings, looking at the effect of U-boat wolf packs during the Second World War and the damage done to Allied shipping from the US and Canada to Great Britain. The popular view is that by kind of 1941, 1942, the effects of shipping being sunk was pushing the country towards emergency measures and rationing and hardship and hunger, and that Churchill popularly said the Battle of the Atlantic was the only battle of the war that ever truly frightened him, and that had it been lost, then Britain would have had to have kind of capitulated. Now, the extent to which this is true is challenged by some of the arguments put forward by Max Hastings in All Hell Let Loose that we're going to explore now. And in his chapter on Great Britain at Sea, he argues that in fact, actually, the war that was prosecuted by Admiral Carl Dönitz, the head of the U-boat command of the German Kriegsmarine, was very, very badly done for the most part, and done with kind of immense kind of inadequacy, that Dönitz didn't really anticipate waging this kind of a war in the Atlantic, much as the German Luftwaffe didn't really anticipate having to wage a campaign of mass bombing or mass terror bombing over Great Britain, which it was not really equipped for. Small, short-range U-boats that were the bulk of the Kriegsmarine U-boat force were designed to operate from German bases. They were not really designed for the kinds of conditions, the kinds of journeys they were taking out into the Atlantic. But much of what Hitler does is kind of improvisational. He's fighting a war that he didn't expect to fight. There's a really great account in Blood and Ruins by Richard Overy, which I'm going to talk about more on this podcast pretty soon, about how his thesis that Hitler, Mussolini, and the imperial government in Tokyo all wanted to fight limited wars of imperial expansion, carving out their own spheres of influence, and they were not looking to fight global conflicts. Now, this is a contested area, but the inability of Germany to adapt fully to global conflict and to have the equipment there to do it would sort of point in that direction. Production in Germany's shipyards, hampered by shortages of steel and skilled labour, and later by bombing, fell below British levels, argues Max Hastings. U-boats remained technically primitive. Innovation, for instance, in 1944... the 1944-45 Schnorkel underwater air replenishment system was not matched by reliability. The revolutionary Type 21 U-boat sailed in its first war patrol only on the 30th of April 1945. And of course, the war ends 8 days later. So, Max Hastings writes, thus Dönitz's force lacked mass, range and quality. Just as the Luftwaffe in 1940-41 attempted to deal a knockout blow to Britain with wholly inadequate resources, so the U-boat arm lacked strength to accomplish the severance of the Atlantic link. Germany never built anything like enough submarines to make them a war-winning weapon. Dönitz calculated that he needed to sink 600,000 tons of British shipping a month in order to achieve a decisive victory, for which he required 300 U-boats in commission to sustain a third of that number in operational areas. Yet the 13 U-boats that were on station in August 1940, falling to 8 in January 1941, rising to 21 the following month. This small force inflicted impressive destruction. 2 million tons of British shipping were sunk between June 1940 and March 1941. But in the same period, just 72 new U-boats were delivered, far short of the number Dönitz needed. They achieved the highest rate of productivity, measured by tonnage sunk per submarine at sea, in October 1940. Thereafter, while many more boats were deployed, their pro rata achievements were diminished. As the war developed, While the Allied navies grew apace in skill and professionalism, the quality and determination of U-boat crews declined. One by one, Dönitz's aces were killed or captured, and the men who replaced them were of lesser caliber. German torpedo technology was almost as flawed as that of the 1942-43 US Navy. I think we've covered this in the past. Direction of the U-boat campaign was hampered by changing strategies and impulsive interventions by Hitler. German naval intelligence and grasp of Allied strategy, tactics and technology were chronically weak. It is a remarkable and important statistic that 99% of the ships which sailed from North America to Britain during the war years arrived safely. So there we have a really, really interesting kind of revisionist argument. I mean, part of the issue with our kind of collective recollection of the war at sea is its popularization. It's made for many incredible war movies, not to mention obviously Das Boot, which looks at it from the perspective of a German U-boat crew. But I think there are two interesting takeaways there. Firstly is the rapidity of decline of German successes from 1940 onwards, from the peak month of October 1940. German U-boat aces, there were only really a kind of a fixed number of super talented commanders. This points to Germany's lack of capacity for replacing these sorts of individuals. It's all fine and well to have a generation of talented people in your army or your navy, but the skill that America particularly mastered was the mass production of high caliber airmen, naval officers, and military commanders. There's a kind of an interesting comparison between the US Air Force in the Pacific and the Japanese Air Force. The Japanese Air Force limited the number of pilots that they had because these were seen as prestige positions. These were, you know, the proverbial samurai, whereas America mass trained high quality pilots and mass produced aircraft in a way that Japan couldn't. The inability to replace top caliber submarine crews and the lack of manufacturing output to create sufficient numbers of U-boats is a really, really telling as it comes to Germany. Hitler deprioritized the Kriegsmarine. This was for him, in terms of material, the army came first, the air force came second, and the navy a third. He wasn't a navy man, and didn't particularly see how the navy fitted into his overall plans, which were the conquest of Russia all the way up to the Volga River. So, I mean, he didn't completely dismiss the navy either, and it says that Hitler's later interventions, sort of his interfering in matters of strategy that he didn't really understand, this had an effect, you know, on all three branches of the German military. The other thing there is this startling statistic that 99% of all ships that cross the Atlantic arrive safely. You have to remember that the war in the Atlantic doesn't last from 1939 to 45. By kind of mid to late 1942, it's really being won. 1942 is the key battleground year. So if you were a sailor in 41-42, it's entirely possible this is really dangerous and the attrition rate is significantly higher if you're a merchant vessel at that time. However, the statistics kind of shift in favour of that 99% figure as we go into the years of 1943, 44, 45. And of course, in those years, the flow of troops and material coming across the Atlantic dramatically increases. So it's not to say that the 99% figure isn't correct, but it's you have to kind of look at it in context of what was happening. Max Hastings writes, even in the bad days of April 1941, for instance, 307 merchantmen sailed in convoy, of which only 16 were sunk, together with a further 11 unescorted vessels. In June that year, 383 ships made the Atlantic passage, in convoys of which submarines attacked only one, sinking six ships, along with a further 22 unescorted merchantmen. In 1942, by far the most alarming year of the U-boat war, 609 ships were sunk in the North Atlantic, a total of some 6 million tons. So prodigious was the was American shipbuilding capacity, however, that in the same period, Allies launched 7.1 million tons of ships, increasing their available pool of 30 million tons. So part of the story here is, again, America's enormous productive capacity, the building of Liberty ships, which sometimes took a matter of days to put together, and the ability of Roosevelt to have redirected almost the entire productive capacity of the United States to war production, a feat of transformation, which kind of makes the New Deal years look kind of comparatively minor in terms of resource allocation and state intervention and all the rest. So it's an extraordinary achievement. And it is, you know, one of those things when you think about the course of the Second World War and almost the kind of the kind of I don't use the word inevitability lightly, but there seems to be very little argument that Germany could ever have finally stood up against the productive capacity of the USA. Despite all of this, there is this kind of assumption, and there was an assumption at the time, particularly in the US and British navies, and from Roosevelt and Churchill as well, that the Allies were doing particularly badly at sea, and all was, you know, very, very bleak. Max Hastings writes, yet, as is the way of mankind, the Allies perceived most of the difficulties on their own side, while posterity knows that in 1942 the U-boats inflicted the utmost damage of which they were capable, and that thereafter the tide of the convoy war turned steadily against them. At the time, Churchill and Roosevelt saw only a steep rising graph of losses, which, if it had continued, would have crippled the war effort. In 1942, British imports fell by 5 million tons, imposing severe strains on food and oil supplies. The latter were reduced by about 15%, requiring the government to dip into its admittedly large strategic stockpiles. This was attributable less to Dönitz than to the diversion of 200 ships from the Atlantic shuttle to open an Arctic supply line to Russia. Whatever the causes, however, Britain's shrunken deliveries alarmed the nation with its back to the wall in many theatres and three dimensions. So this provides us with a kind of another interesting point, another interesting clue here, that the opening of the Arctic convoy to supply Soviet Russia was a key factor in actually the lack of overall shipping for British domestic needs. And this perhaps, you know, occupied the minds of the British, of the Allied planners at the time. And sometimes there are things that occur in war that only future historians are going to be able to make sense of, or sort of look at the wider picture of, that leaders at the time have precious little ability to discern, you know, because these things are complicated and chaotic. Now, looking at the question of air power over the Atlantic, which was another key reason why the German U-boats began to lose their effectiveness and to be destroyed, Max Hastings writes, "Even when the US supplied Britain with a few B-24 Liberators, suitable for very long-range conversion, and thus ideal for Atlantic convoy support, initially the RAF chose to use them, use most of them elsewhere. Sir Arthur Bomber Harris, the Commander-in-Chief of Bomber Command 1942-45, fiercely resisted the diversion of heavy aircraft to the convoy war. It was a continual fight against the Navy to stop them, as usual, pinching everything," said Harris, who disliked British sailors almost as much as he abhorred the Germans. "Half my energies were giving to save Bomber Command from the other services. The Navy and the Army were always trying to belittle the work of the Air Force. The Atlantic Gap, the area of ocean beyond the range of land-based cover, remained the focus of U-boat activity until 1943. An average of just over one convoy a week each way made the North Atlantic passage. Many crossed without suffering attack because the Germans did not locate them. Ultra intercepts of U-boat position reports, together with HuffDuff, high-frequency direction finding by warships, often made it possible to divert convoys away from enemy concentrations. One statistical calculation suggests that in the second 6 months of 1941 alone, Ultra saved between 1.5 and 2 million tons of Allied shipping from destruction." Ultra, of course, being the decryption system at Bletchley Park, where the decryption of the German Enigma code. "For a few months in 1941, American escorts protected convoys east of Iceland, but after Pearl Harbor, these were withdrawn. Canadian corvettes took up the strain, and the Royal Navy assumed responsibility once ships entered the western approaches. Throughout 1941 to 43, the key period of the Battle of the Atlantic, the Admiralty supplied 50% of all escorts, the Royal Canadian Navy 46%, and the American vessels made up the balance." So, American ships 41 to 43, as kind of convoy ships, make up very, very little of the actual tonnage of shipping escorting Allied convoys. "Yet if the German offensive was mismanaged, especially in 1941 to 42, Allied merchant seamen suffered grievously from its consequences. Crews were drawn from many nationalities, though some young British chose the merchant service in preference to conscription into the armed forces. It would be hard to argue that this represented a soft option. Some seamen were obliged to abandon ship two or three times." So, we'll look more in a future podcast about the experiences of merchant seamen at war. I think there is an important point here. You know, we've been looking at a macro picture. We've been looking at statistically the entire war and saying, you know, this 99% figure that does actually suggest that we've kind of radically overestimated the danger that the U-boats posed. But when you look at it in a kind of on a micro level, when you look at the actual destruction and what it must have been like to go overboard, go into the water or onto a life raft, these are truly terrifying happenings, and there were merchant sailors who were who survived and had been torpedoed several times. So macro pictures never really tell us the micro story. But we will kind of get into that later. So, what can we extrapolate here about the war itself? Well, as with so many aspects of the Second World War, once the initial phase of successes was over, once Germany had had the victories on land and sea that it was going to have, it was very difficult for Germany to continue to replicate those. There's a reason why, you know, the year of 1940 is referred by U-boat commanders as the happy times, and after that the happy times go into rapid decline. The war that Hitler was trying to fight, as it mentions here, is a lot of improvisation. It is the very often the wrong tools for the wrong job, and the initial successes are often based on a lack of Allied preparedness, dumb luck, and a range of other factors, which convinced Hitler, the inveterate gambler, that anything and everything was possible, continuously possible, something his general staff and the heads of the Kriegsmarine hotly disputed. But because of the degree of micromanagement and authoritarianism in military decision making, it becomes harder and harder for those that really know what they're doing to be able to have influence. Anyway, we'll look at that again soon. I quite like talking about the Battle of the Atlantic. Some interesting stuff coming up in January. So the first ever Explaining History Academy, to give it its true and pretentious title, study course is going to be ready sometime mid-January. We're starting off by looking at Russia from 1856 to 1953, so from the Crimean War to the death of Stalin. And so it's mainly geared up for students, so there's going to be plenty of stuff in there on how to study, writing, study techniques, how to think like a historian, all that kind of stuff, which I'll bore you with more later on. But if you're a generalist and you just want to understand the history of Russia in the 19th and 20th centuries, dive right in. Anyway, I'll be posting links to it, I'm sure it'll be useful, so keep your eyes peeled for that one. Anyway, that bit of advertising puff, let's finish up, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best, bye bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.